This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, was last month's U.S. cruise missile attack on targets in Syria legal?
Not only was it not legal under both American and international law, but the allegation that the United States made about the president of Syria, Assad, using gas on his own people is probably a lie.
We'll also hear Medea Benjamin talking about her new book, Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
With Trump, Bolton, and the war cabinet, it's looking increasingly likely that the United States and its allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, want to attack Iran. Nothing could be more important than this talk.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The April American cruise missile attack on alleged chemical war infrastructure in Douma, Syria, has been defended as legitimate, if not legal. Trump called Syrian President Assad an animal who gassed his own people and had to be deterred from further attacks on them. Critics of the attack have said that it violated both American and international law and risked nuclear warfare. They argue that our Constitution states that only Congress can declare war, that there was no question of self-defense, and that the United States was under that there was no question of self-defense, inasmuch as the United States was not under attack, and that in any case, the United Nations Charter, to which the United States is a signatory, precludes what the United States did. The UN Charter is a treaty which binds America and is part of American law. We speak today with attorney Marjorie Cohn. She is a professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego and a former president of the National Lawyers Guild.
Marjorie Cohn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the legality of the recent U.S. cruise missile attack on Syria. Was it legal?
No, it was not. It violated both international and U.S. law, and that is the U.N. Charter and the War Powers Resolution. The United Nations Charter requires that disputes between countries, between states, be settled peacefully, and the Charter prohibits the use of military force except in self-defense after an armed attack by another state or when the Security Council has approved the use of military force, and neither of those two requirements was present before the April 13th strikes on Syria. The War Powers Resolution was passed by Congress in the wake of the Vietnam War, and it allows the president to introduce U.S. troops into hostilities or imminent hostilities only when Congress has declared war, which had not happened before the Syria strikes, or when Congress has passed specific statutory authorization for the use of military force. Again, Congress had not passed any authorization for the bombing of Syria. Or when there's a national emergency created by an attack upon the United States, its territories, or possessions or armed forces. Again, that had not occurred. So it violated the War Powers Resolution. And the authorization for the use of military force, which is being debated in Congress next week, there's a new draft introduced, bipartisan draft introduced, that would basically give Trump carte blanche to go anywhere he wants under the guise of attacking ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or the Taliban. Not clear whether that will even come to the floor. There were two prior authorizations for the use of military force. Neither of them covers the Syria situation. But when Trump sent 59 Tomahawk missiles to bomb Syria a year ago, in apparent retaliation against a sarin attack that Assad had allegedly carried out, James Mattis said in February that they had no evidence. This last February, they actually had no evidence that of that sarin attack. The administration didn't use the AMF to justify the legality of that 2017 attack, but rather they cited the president's commander-in-chief authority under Article 2 of the Constitution to defend important U.S. interests. Article 2 only gives the president power to command the U.S. military once Congress has authorized war under Article 1 of the Constitution. So the Constitution does not give a legal basis either. And after the 2017 attack, Protect Democracy, which is a group of former Obama administration lawyers, filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to make public the Trump administration's memo, the Office of Legal Counsel memo, detailing its legal justification for the 2017 U.S. military strike on Syria. And the administration says, no, that memo is classified. But during the litigation, Protect Democracy discovered that the classified portion could easily be redacted or edited out. Nevertheless, the administration refuses to make the memo public, and Protect Democracy filed an emergency motion for release of the memo in light of the then potentially imminent military action in Syria. So that's the long answer to your question. No, the military strikes, U.S.-UK, France military strikes on Syria were not legal.
But even more fundamental than the illegality of the strikes is the notion that there may never have been a use of gas by Syria to begin with. Even the U.S. Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, said that he had no evidence that Syrian President Assad ordered the attack. But nonetheless, Mattis said that he believed that it did. And that's a statement of faith, isn't it? Why was there no independent investigation before the attack?
Yes, well, Mattis told the House Armed Services Committee, I think it was the day before the attack, quote, I believe there was a chemical attack, and we are looking for the actual evidence, unquote. And Mattis told the Armed Services Committee that he wanted inspectors in Syria, quote, probably within the week, unquote. Well, the next day, the bombing took place. Trump wanted to make good on his two threatening tweets. He wants to distract from the Mueller investigation, which is closing in on him, and the investigation of his lawyer, Michael Cohen. Trump realized when he sent the 59 Tomahawk missiles to Syria a year ago that it made him look tough. People like Fareed Zakaria were saying now he's acting presidential. So he was champing at the bit. And Mattis was, Mad Dog Mattis, ironically, was trying to put the brakes on. He argued that they should get congressional approval, and he was voted down before the strikes. And then Trump was threatening Russia and wanted to make a big splash and probably get us into World War III. But Mattis prevailed and limited the strikes to three targets that did not risk endangering Russian troops, which would have, Russia said, would have led to retaliation on their part.
Why was diplomacy not employed?
Well, because, first of all, Trump doesn't believe in diplomacy. Nikki Haley, his UN ambassador, doesn't believe in diplomacy. And now we have John Bolton at his side, the new national security advisor, who couldn't get confirmed as U.S. ambassador to the UN under the George W. Bush administration, even though there was a Republican Congress, and so was appointed in a recess appointment to be UN ambassador. John Bolton famously has contempt for the UN. In 1994, Bolton claimed there's no such thing as the United Nations. He said if the UN Secretariat building in New York lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. And when Bolton officially, in his capacity in the Bush administration in 2002, officially withdrew the U.S. signature from the International Criminal Court Treaty, Bolton declared it was, quote, the happiest moment of my government service, unquote. So now we have Bolton by Trump's side, and Bolton is an uber hawk. He wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal claiming that the U.S. could mount a preemptive strike on North Korea legally, which no reputable legal scholar would ever agree with. And he is there right by Trump's side. He was there when they were when he was on TV in the hearing the next day talking about the Syria situation. There was Bolton right by his side. So I think it's a combination of those things. Diplomacy does not appear to be in the Trump administration's toolkit.
Getting back to the was there even a gas attack, Robert Fisk, the great journalist who was covering the war, went to Douma, Syria, the site of the alleged attack, and he wrote that people were not gassed. He interviewed a doctor who said that the people got sick and died because they live in tunnels, and there was all kinds of dust stirred up by bombings, and they died from lack of oxygen. What evidence has come out on this?
Yeah, the watchdog committee, the OPCW, which is the committee set up or the organization set up by the Chemical Weapons Convention to do investigations, was on its way to Syria to investigate when Trump started bombing. The investigation has not been completed. And it's counterintuitive to think that Assad would have bombed with gas in that area of Douma. Assad had already taken back from the rebels over 90% of eastern Ghouta, which includes Douma. And moreover, Trump announced the week before that he intended to withdraw the 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria. He's since backtracked on that. But it's given those two factors before Trump did bomb Syria, it's counterintuitive to think that Assad would have launched a gas attack. And in 2017, when Trump bombed Syria after declaring Assad had used sarin gas 2 days earlier, he ignored all the dissenting voices. That Assad's responsibility for that 2017 attack has never been definitively confirmed. And in fact, as I said, Mattis admitted last February had no evidence that Assad used sarin gas against the Syrian people. And Trump, before bombing Syria this time, Trump said the United States is, quote, getting clarity and has some pretty good answers, unquote, about who was responsible. I mean, that's, and you're right, going on faith just doesn't cut it, but he wanted to make a big dramatic show. He wanted to show who's in charge. Certainly, this enriches the defense contractors who stood to gain incredible amounts of money with these bombings. And it also risked a war with Russia, which is, and even though they tried to mount these kind of surgical strikes, one of them, at least one of them, is reportedly a pharmaceutical plant. It's not even a chemical, it doesn't even have chemical weapons. I'm not sure about the others. But Trump was bound and determined to do it, and it was just a question of the scope and the scale, and Mattis trying to rein him in as best he could.
I want to point out as an aside that each cruise missile, and they fired, I think, 117, if I'm right, but each one costs over $1 million. They're made by Raytheon, I think. So you've got a huge amount of money spent, and those missiles will be replaced. So as you say, the military-industrial complex had a field day with it. But I wanted to ask you something really profound, Marjorie. In 1946, a year after the end of World War II, the United States and its allies tried the Nazi war criminals in Nuremberg, and they elucidated a number of principles about the war of aggression. And Robert Jackson, the prosecutor, said that a war of aggression is really the supreme crime because it has within it all the elements of every other crime. And do you think what the United States did in Syria was a crime of aggression?
Yes, it was, Michael. Crime of aggression is defined as something that violates a treaty, particularly the UN Charter, and it was one of the four crimes punishable at Nuremberg, along with war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. The crime of aggression is punishable in the International Criminal Court, and they finally, the states parties to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court finally agreed on a definition of aggression, so they're going to start prosecuting, or at least theoretically, they're going to start prosecuting leaders for the crime of aggression. But the crime of aggression, when Justice Jackson said what you just quoted, that it is the supreme international crime, is because it includes within it all of the other main crimes, and that is genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And if you look at, there are no more serious crimes than those three, but then aggression combines all three of them. So this is very, very serious stuff. And you're right, this started at Nuremberg with the Nuremberg Tribunal, where Nazi leaders were tried for the crime of aggression. And these attacks in Syria did constitute a crime of aggression.
Marjorie, you've hinted at the answer, but why do you think in the big picture the United States did what it did? Is it to keep, so to say, the pot boiling in the Middle East in favor of Israel and Saudi Arabia?
I think it is. And I mean, I talked about Trump's own personal reasons for wanting to be known as a tough bomber. But there are also geopolitical reasons, which he may or may not understand, but certainly people in his administration do. And former New York Times correspondent Stephen Kinzer actually explained a very logical reason why the U.S., U.K., and France keep intervening in Syria. And he said they're opposed to allowing a peaceful resolution in Syria because that might allow stability to spread to nearby countries. He said that the governments of Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Lebanon are on good terms. A partnership among them could lay the foundation for a new Middle East, which would not be submissive to the U.S.-Israeli-Saudi Arabia coalition. And I think he really hit the nail on the head. There is a strategic reason why we are doing what we're doing there. And it's interesting, when Trump, the week before the attacks, said he was going to pull the U.S. troops out of Syria, and people in his administration, including Mattis, said, oh, my gosh, we can't do that, and they talked him out of it. That was actually a good instinct on Trump's part. But, you know, he was quickly reined in. But now my understanding is that he would still like to pull the U.S. troops out, but is pressuring other countries to take the U.S. troops' place in Syria. But there is no way that this can end well. We're talking about a cauldron, I think, is what Robert Fisk called the Middle East many years ago, and catastrophic what could happen if this spirals out of control, and when there is someone like Trump in the White House, and of course there is no one like Trump, but Trump is in the White House, we should be very, very concerned, and we should be pressuring our congressmen and women to vote against this new authorization for the use of military force if it does come to the floor of the House and the Senate, because it would basically give Trump carte blanche to, with no geographic limitation whatsoever, to make war, and would put a stamp of legal approval on it, even though it would still violate the UN Charter, but it would put the stamp of U.S. legal approval on it, and we should not allow that to happen.
Marjorie, you somewhat answered one of my final questions. We usually try to insert some hope into dire topics that we cover. And this is a pretty serious one, as you've said. In the next few months, and you've started to answer this, could you sort of quickly lay out the best and worst case scenario? If things go well, can we turn things around? And if not, what do you think might happen?
Well, it's really up to the people to turn things around, and we have the 2018 midterm elections coming up, which are critical, not just for this issue, but for many, many issues, as I'm sure people are aware. The Democrats have not been terribly critical of what Trump did in Syria. Some of them have come out and criticized it, including Bernie Sanders. So I think the responsibility is on us, we the people, to pressure our congressional representatives, and that means directly by emails, writing, sitting in their offices, demonstrating, and pressuring them to do the right thing, but also very important to vote. And young people with the anti-gun violence movement have really taken off with how important that is, and young people are being being mobilized, and hopefully they will make connections beyond the gun violence, which many of them are already starting to do, with the militarization of the police, militarization against black people at home, and militarism abroad. So I don't want to talk about the worst-case scenario, because that would be nuclear war with Russia, and I don't even want to say it. It's just too outrageous to imagine. But Trump certainly has indicated that he would like to use nuclear weapons. Now, there is a very positive development, and that is North and South Korea have declared an official end to their war, going back to 1950-53, and Pompeo, the CIA director, and soon to be Secretary of State, met with Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang in a preliminary meeting to lay the groundwork for Trump to meet with Kim Jong-un. And I think that that is a very positive development, and I'm very hopeful that that will have good results. But the problem with Trump is that he can say one thing one day and do something else the next day. He's very unpredictable and very volatile, and we need to rein him in whatever way possible. Robert Mueller is doing his job, and certainly if the Democrats take back either or both houses of Congress in the midterm elections later this year, that would also be quite helpful.
In the few remaining minutes that we have allotted to us, I wanted to ask you about your book and ask you to please talk about it.
It's Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. It just came out in an updated second edition, and it is a collection of essays, an interdisciplinary collection of essays by legal scholars, philosophers, journalists, people who are talking about different aspects of the killer drone program. And Bush started the use of killer drones in Yemen. Obama expanded that. Obama was using drones to kill people in seven different countries, allegedly killing the terrorists, killing an awful lot of civilians, and Trump has continued to use the drones. And now the reason they like drones is because there's no pilot to be killed. One thing the U.S. government learned during the Vietnam War is that Americans don't like to see U.S. soldiers coming back in body bags. So when you can kill people surgically, and I use that advisedly, with unmanned bombers, it plays well in the U.S., and people in this country don't see the images or hear the stories of the victims of these drone killings. They're just horrific. There have been whistleblowers. In fact, the second edition of the book has an essay by Sean Westmoreland, who was in the Air Force, who was instrumental to the drone program, who later became a whistleblower. It's called Epiphany of a drone whistleblower, and it's very, very good that these people are coming out and talking. Lisa Ling, many of the others, talking about what they did in the drone program. There have been a number of films as well, but people in this country really have no sense of that, because we don't see Americans being killed. We don't see what's happening over there, and yet it's going on. And the next iteration is autonomous drones, where it will be a computer that decides who, when, and where to kill with drones. And the UN is very concerned about that. They have called for a moratorium on autonomous drones, but the technology is developing rapidly, and that's very worrisome. Also, the book talks about surveillance drones used in the United States by law enforcement at the border, part of this militarization of law enforcement.
The name of the book again, Marjorie Cohn?
Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues.
And if our listeners want to keep in touch with your writings, what do they do?
My articles, I have a weekly column on Truthout. My articles go to many of the blogs, but they are archived at marjoriecohn.com.
Marjorie Cohn, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
I just wanted to say, Marjorie, thank you for really an excellent overview of a complex situation. I know our listeners will learn a lot.
You take it easy.
Thanks so much, both of you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last month, our own Heidi Boghossian welcomed Medea Benjamin, author of the new book, Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Medea Benjamin gave a book talk at the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute. Let's take a listen.
Thank you and welcome to the Mustey Institute here at the Interim Peace Pentagon. Her name is synonymous with activism, as well as many other terms, human rights, social justice, peace, all words that inform the work of the Mustey Institute and of our many groups, from the War Resisters League to the Granny Peace Brigade to New York State Youth Leadership and the National Lawyers Guild, Met Council on Housing. Thank you for coming. When I asked one of our tenants what they think of when they hear Medea's name, he said, getting hauled out of a congressional hearing. And I'm sure that we each have our own favorite Medea memory. When she stands up to our elected officials and holds them accountable for any number of human rights violations. But as you know, just a brief introduction, Medea is co-founder of the women-led peace group Code Pink and also co-founder of the human rights organization Global Exchange. One of Code Pink's first actions was singing an anti-war Christmas carol outside Defense Secretary Rumsfeld's home in Washington, D.C. Medea has advocated for social justice for more than four decades. Our own New York Newsday describes her as one of America's most committed and most effective fighters for human rights. Medea was one of 1,000 exemplary women from 140 countries nominated to receive the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the millions of women doing essential work of peace worldwide. This is Medea's 10th book. She wrote Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control earlier, and I know many of you love that book. And we'll be hearing about Inside Iran in a minute. I just wanted to end by noting that Code Pink has inspired people around the world to take action. And we here applaud their creativity in the many forms of protest they engage in that pique the interest of new protesters and old protesters alike. Medea was a recipient of the 2014 Gandhi Prize from the group Promoting Enduring Peace. And as special thanks for coming here today to speak at the A.J. Mustey Institute, we'd like to present her with a biography of A.J. Mustey, American Gandhi, because I think it really resonates with who Medea is.
Well, thank you for that beautiful introduction. It's funny you said getting hauled out of Congress as one of the things I'm associated with, because we were at the hearing for Mike Pompeo as the new Secretary of State, and I kept saying, I can't get arrested, I can't get arrested, I have to be in New York tonight. So a wonderful woman that some of you know, Anne Wright, former diplomat and colonel in the U.S. Army, was the one to get arrested today, standing up and saying, I'm a diplomat and I know that that guy is no diplomat. It is really troubling times when some people who thought Donald Trump might have a silver lining as being a non-interventionist because of things that he said during the campaign, like saying to Jeb Bush, your brother got us into the horrible war in Iraq, and that's cost us trillions of dollars. And he continues to say, why are we spending all this money in the Middle East, and what do we get for it? More death and destruction. He recently said that he was getting our troops out of Syria and, of course, changed his mind the next day. But he did come across as somebody who recognized that U.S. involvement in the Middle East was not really in the national interests of the United States. He didn't much care about the people in the Middle East. I don't recall him ever saying that it was bad for the about a million Iraqis who perished as a result of our invasion, or the millions of Syrians who have been displaced, or the Afghan people who continue to suffer from endless conflict. But when he got into power, he had a very different story. And one of those is really the people he is surrounding himself with. And after he's been in power for a while now, it's all the more disconcerting that he's bringing in the real war hawks. It's quite funny that we look back now with nostalgia, perhaps, at Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, who we were horrified about in the beginning, but turned out to be a more moderating influence on Trump. And now we are, it looks like, about to get a much more militarist person in that position. And horror of all horrors to me is the person who is now the National Security Advisor. To have John Bolton in that position is really horrifying. To think that this is a man who is just so much the opposite of what you want, or who you want, whispering in Donald Trump's ear day after day about how to conduct U.S. foreign policy. You in New York, of course, know that he was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, where he distinguished himself as being really mean and nasty and hard to work with, and of course to use his veto power whenever he could to stop any accountability either from the United States or from U.S. allies like Israel, and where he has now been elevated despite the fact that he has not only performed miserably in his jobs, but he's one of the people who was a major cheerleader for the invasion of Iraq and never went back and said that it was a terrible mistake, as many others have done. So both Pompeo and Bolton have on record talked about how the Iran nuclear deal is a disaster, how talking with North Korea is a waste of time. And here we have the positive development in the case of North Korea that Donald Trump has said that he is going to talk to Kim Jong-un, which is really so important. And it makes me very sad that there are some Democrats who denounce that just because it's Donald Trump. We need to say that that's a positive thing. We want people in power to be talking to our adversaries. But it is worrisome that he's going to have Bolton and potentially Pompeo there to muck up the talks, to perhaps say very quickly that we can't get the kind of concessions we need to get from North Korea, and so talks are not worth it, and let's go ahead and try the bombing campaign. And in the case of Iran, I think it's even more dangerous. In fact, I think that maybe there will be long drawn out talks with North Korea, which would be a positive thing. And in the meantime, that will be used as the way to say, see, we are engaged in discussions with those who will talk to us, but Iran is a different story. So we have a deadline coming up very soon of May 12th. Which is when Trump said that he does not want to reimpose the waiver that would, and when he doesn't impose the waiver, that means that the sanctions that were imposed because of the Iran nuclear deal would be lifted. So those sanctions would then be in place, and that would be disastrous for the Iranian people. Already, the U.S. has destroyed the Iranian economy. If you look at over the years, there have been sanctions against Iran basically since 1979. And those sanctions have forced the Iranian people to look inward on how to develop their own technology in all kinds of ways. But it's also meant that Iran has been held back from trade with the rest of the world, and that when you have a regime that has strong sanctions against it, it means the government has actually more power over the people. And you would think that this is known to our government officials when they impose sanctions, whether it's on North Korea or Iran. It's not the high-up people in office who are suffering from the sanctions. It is the ordinary civilians. And they are the ones who then have to depend on their government for all kinds of access to goods and services that would normally be available were there an open free market. So the sanctions are something that strengthen the hardliners in Iran and strengthen the government and also allow for a lot more corruption. And when you have only certain ways of getting access to bank loans, to finances, it means that there is a lot of under-the-table kind of things going on. And Iran today is on the scale worldwide one of the more corrupt countries in terms of ability to do business. So now, in just the last couple of weeks, there's been a tremendous devaluation of the Iranian currency, the rial. And one of the reasons for this is the appointment of Bolton. In fact, it was when Bolton was appointed that there was a tremendous dive in the currency. And this has exacerbated the economic crisis there. People are having a very difficult time accessing their accounts, especially accounts that are in hard currency. And the papers are talking about how the U.S. should take advantage of this because this is the time to squeeze them even further. And if you remember you could go back to the 1973 coup in Chile when Kissinger was in power and talked about how we want to make the economy scream. This is the same kind of thing. You might remember at the very end of December of last year and the beginning of January of this year, there were a number of protests that happened in Iran. They started out in one city and then moved to several different cities. And there was tremendous glee, not only among our government officials, but among our media, that this was going to be it. This was going to ignite the revolution in Iran and tremendous cheering of the protests. The protests were about economic issues. And certainly people have lots of reasons to protest in Iran, just like they have lots of reasons to protest all over the world. But the U.S. officials and people who are in positions of supporting non-government organizations inside Iran surreptitiously really tried to help feed this and were very disappointed when the government cracked down and the movement died out. And they're hoping now with the present economic crisis that this will be another spark that will lead to more protests. And so if the U.S. pulls out of the Iran nuclear deal and imposes further sanctions on Iran, it could be a very disastrous economic crisis in Iran. I give that as preface for talking about this book because some of you might know that my last book was about Saudi Arabia. And I was really appalled by the fact that the U.S. has this incredibly close alliance with the Saudi regime that is the regime most responsible for spreading terrorism around the world. Let's not forget here in New York City that 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, that Saudi Arabia has tried, but unsuccessfully, it looks like, to stop any accountability in U.S. courts for their involvement in the 9/11 attacks, that Saudi Arabia is based on a perversion of Islam called Wahhabism that is the most intolerant version of Islam that has been spread around by Saudi money to countries all over, not just the Middle East, but North Africa, other parts of Asia, and that Saudi Arabia has used its power to crush any internal dissent in the most brutal ways. And it has used its power to crush democratic uprising in neighboring countries like in Bahrain and is responsible for the greatest humanitarian catastrophe in the world right now, which is Yemen. And it could not be done without U.S. support. So I thought it was very important to write a book about Saudi Arabia to help educate Americans about the horror that lies behind the U.S.-Saudi relationship, a relationship that started out because of all the oil in Saudi Arabia that was discovered in 1938, and over the years, yes, was very dependent on the fact that Saudi Arabia had these vast oil reserves. But in more recent years, it became an issue that Saudi Arabia, with all its petrodollars, became the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons from the United States. And so just think of this. The country most responsible for spreading terrorism, this country that allows no internal dissent, that has no freedom of press, freedom of association, no national elections whatsoever, that passes down reign from one bloodline of the House of Saud to another, is the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons in the world and uses them to create war crimes in neighboring countries. And yet, the U.S. government forgives Saudi Arabia for all of its problems and lack of democracy because it has so much money. And you would think after 9/11 and with the Sunni repressive regimes that exist around the world, there would be a look at Iran to say, well, maybe Iran should be more of an ally of the United States. Iran has not tried to spread this perverted version of Islam around, but no. And so I thought it was important to then write a sequel or a companion book, which is about Iran. And because I'm addressing a group here that knows a lot about U.S. history, you might know that Iran, unlike Saudi Arabia, which is a very new country, founded in 1932, Iran is a Persian country with a history that goes back 2,500 years. So imagine how hard it was to write in the first chapter the history of 2,500 years. I crammed a lot into that one chapter and then went on to talk about the U.S. relationship and what happened after the Shah came into power and the Pahlavi dynasty that has gone on from 1926, the father to the son, and really focused a lot on what happened in terms of the Iranian effort starting in 1951 to nationalize its oil. And like many countries around the world, when there is a democratic opportunity for people to be elected on a platform of saying our resources belong to the people, not to foreign oil companies. In this case, it would be the the UK company that turned into BP. Both the British and then the United States said that we cannot abide by this, and in 1953 orchestrated the coup of the democratically elected Prime Minister of Mossadegh. This really was a turning point in U.S.-Iranian relations. It was the first successful CIA covert operation of its kind, which then became the model for things like the year later of the Jacobo Arbenz government in Guatemala, the overthrow of Lumumba in 1960 in the Congo. What it left behind in its wake was incredible repression that came down after the coup on the people and paved the way, really, for several decades later, the revolution of 1979. I wanted to just quote something from Bernie Sanders, who, during his campaign for his campaign for president, talked very little about foreign relations. He really focused on the domestic issues. And it was after his campaign, he gave a great foreign policy speech. And one of the things he said in that speech was, in 1953, the United States, on behalf of Western oil interests, supported the overthrow of Iran's elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh and the reinstallation of the Shah of Iran, who led a corrupt, brutal, and unpopular government. In 1979, Bernie Sanders said, the Shah was overthrown by revolutionaries led by Ayatollah Khomeini, and the Islamic Republic of Iran was created. And then he asked these questions. He said, what would Iran look like today if their democratic government had not been overthrown? What impact did that American-led coup have on the entire region? And what consequences are we still living with today? And I think those are incredibly important questions. And they're questions that I try to answer in the book. I want to jump forward now to where we are today, because I think when we talk about the relations between the U.S. and Iran, the difficult times, I want to have that as a large part of what we discuss in the Q&A, but I want to throw a couple of other things in there. You might remember when the Muslim ban was first imposed by the Trump administration, and then there was a second iteration of that ban. You know, Saudi Arabia was never on the list of countries that the people should be banned. I'm not saying it should be, because I think the whole ban is horrendous, but just to point out that Iran was put on the ban. There has never been anybody from Iran who has been related to a terrorist attack in the United States. Nevertheless, the Trump administration put Iranians on that ban. That has caused a lot of problems between Iran and the United States, even among people inside Iran who hate their own government. Now they see the Trump administration making it difficult for them to see their relatives in the United States, to travel back and forth, students who want to study here, all of that kind of thing. And what else is happening very recently is a triumvirate coming together, and that is Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the United States coming together to focus on Iran. Iran as the great existential threat to the world. It's very interesting because Saudi Arabia and Iran have been enemies. Saudi Arabia was part of the original Arab ban on Israel. They don't have diplomatic relations. And for a long time, no Arab country really wanted to be openly supporting Israel because of the heat in the Arab street about that. But in recent years, there's been a more covert kind of relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And now, more recently, that's just become very open. In fact, you might recall when the Saudi prince was here in the United States, he talked about Israel's right to exist. He was very conciliatory. He met with members of the Jewish community here in the United States, even though, by the way, you could never be a Saudi citizen if you were Jewish. You could never practice your religion in Saudi Arabia if you were Jewish. In fact, until 2004, it was even a law in Saudi Arabia that you could not enter the country if you were Jewish. There is now a sense of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So because Israel is so anti-Iran, and because Saudi Arabia is as well, there is an alliance coming together between the Saudis and Israel and the United States to focus on Iran. Now, part of that is being focused as a proxy war. Some of that you might see in Yemen, where it's the Saudis that are now fighting the Houthis, who have become backed by Iran. Or you might see it in Syria. In fact, very recently, when we had just this week, well, before the week before, with the alleged chemical attack by the Syrian government, a response from Israel that was a bombing of an airbase in Syria, and that airbase was one that was run by Iran, purposely attacked that and killed a number of Iranians. There is now a very dangerous back and forth going between Iran and Israel, where Iran says it's going to retaliate against the Israelis. It even said something like, you know, if the Israelis attack us, we can wipe out Tel Aviv and Haifa. The Israelis responding about how what they can wipe out in Iran. And it's very, very dangerous and very disconcerting. We also have, of course, the escalation of the U.S. rhetoric and back and forth of sanctions with Russia, and the relationship now that is between Iran as an ally of Russia. So all of this can be brewed into a war that is absolutely catastrophic in the Middle East, could potentially include Russia as well, which is the reason why we've got to do all that we can to keep the United States in the Iran nuclear deal. It was interesting today to hear Pompeo, who said, he didn't say, we want to get out of the deal. He said, we want to make the deal better. And then they asked him, well, what if the May 12th passes and the Trump administration pulls out of the deal? And instead of saying, then we would move to an option of military aggression, he said, we would still try to make the deal better, which is quite interesting, I think. I think they're understanding from people in the Pentagon how disastrous it would be if there were a war with Iran, that the U.S. has bases all over the Middle East. The U.S. has military people all over the Middle East. Iran knows well that the way the U.S. is fighting wars right now is to have as few American deaths as possible, because the American people won't tolerate a lot of U.S. soldiers dying. So what would Iran's strategy be? Retaliate against as many U.S. soldiers as it can, either directly as Iran or through its allies, Hezbollah, or Iranian allies in militias in Iraq, of which there are many. So the Pentagon knows that this is very dangerous. And I think if we are able to do our job, which is build up more of an anti-war movement than we've had for the last over 8 years, we could potentially stop this. So I want to leave it on a positive note, which is, some of you might know that there are anti-war rallies that are happening this weekend to call for no retaliation of Syria on Syria, to use negotiations instead. We need to bring into that the issues of we want to stay in the Iran nuclear deal. And then beyond that, we are part of a number of interesting initiatives. Some of you might know about the Poor People's Campaign that Reverend Barber has initiated and is going to start on Mother's Day for 40 days. And I was just in a meeting in Washington, D.C., where there were lots of groups, from interfaith to labor unions to environmental groups and anti-war groups, to coming together. And the agenda of that is very inclusive. And unlike other agendas sometimes where the national groups come together and they forget about the war issues, militarism is right up front and center, because it's really taking off on the twin evils of that Martin Luther King talked about, of poverty, racism, and militarism. And during those 40 days, we're going to have a chance to really work with a broad-based coalition around the country to insert the issue of militarism into all these other key issues that are happening around the country. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that we're part of another coalition that has started a campaign around divesting from the war machine. Because we have to ask in the end, who benefits? Why are we in the state of perpetual war? Because it's profitable. Why do people want to keep the wars going? Because they make a lot of money. It is a big racket. And so it's time for us to take a page from the folks who have been fighting the fossil fuel industry and really push the issue about divesting from the war machine. And we're very excited about this campaign. It's everything from getting what are called socially responsible investment firms to have a screen about the war companies, the weapons industry, whether they're industries that make AK-47s for use here at home, or they're making making bombers to be dropped on people in Yemen, and it's going into universities. I've just started the speaking tour, but the last week I've been speaking to a number of universities, and it's been wonderful to see the enthusiasm they have about finding out where their university is investing their funds and trying to cut the ties with the weapons industry. And one very interesting piece of that campaign is to look at our Congress. You know, when it comes to the NRA, it's the vast majority of money that's given to Congress is to Republicans. There aren't a lot of Democrats that are getting NRA money. But when you look at the larger weapons industry, like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, General Dynamics, they're giving to everybody. And these are unsolicited gifts oftentimes. And what we've been finding out doing the research and then talking to some of these congresspeople is that some of our favorite progressive congresspeople are taking money from these companies. And it really is almost like, oh, well, nobody ever asked me not to. So this is our time to ask them not to. And the response when we've done it has been quite good. Many times they will immediately say, oh, I didn't realize that I was taking money. We say, oh, look, you just got $1,000 from Raytheon and you got $2,000 from Lockheed Martin. They say, oh, I didn't even know. I won't take that anymore. Or they have said, I knew it, but I have Raytheon in my district. And we said, Raytheon is in every district. I mean, that's no excuse. We point out how Donald Trump stood in front of the TV cameras with his Saudi buddy to proclaim how wonderful it was that we were selling all these weapons to Saudi Arabia because they created all these jobs in the United States. And we said, do you want to be part of Trump's agenda, which is to use the death and famine in Yemen as a way to create jobs in your district? And we've had a lot of good conversations. And so far, just starting this campaign, I think we have about 18 of them that have promised not to take money from the weapons industry. So with your help, and don't assume that any progressives in New York are not taking that money, you know, we should go to them and ask them to make a commitment not to take the weapons money. And actually, it's good because we've combined it with the NRA. And as soon as you say the NRA, they're ready to say, oh, of course, I won't take money from the NRA. But then when you bring in the larger weapons industry, then they have to think about it a little more. So these are some of the things that I think that we can do as we're building up or trying to build a new, more vibrant, more inclusive anti-war movement. But we certainly have a lot to do very quickly if we're going to stop this Trump administration from getting us into some new wars. So thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.